accession number 208 50 reel 2.
Jack Sykes, reel 2. And so did you feel an outcast?
No. It was just one of those things that they gave us, D Company. And it was, you know, a joint venture anyway. You know, we were Fusiliers and that was it. But as I say, we were made up of other different regiments, D Company. I don't know why they put us all in D Company, but that's what they seem to do.
And which platoon were you in?
I was in 10th platoon.
Were they all these Surreys?
No, we were, quite a few of them were Surreys. I mean, you didn't know everybody in there, from the Surreys, or wherever they come from.
Do you remember the NCOs and officers in your platoon and company?
Yes, Lieutenant Hall was ours, and Lieutenant Hoare and De Roper were in our companies, and what was his Lieutenant Colonel? I should think of it in a minute.
How did you get on with the NCOs and
fine? Yes, fine. I had a Sergeant Tyler, which I told you about. He was in the same company and platoon. And I never ever thought that when I come out of the army that I would still be in contact with a sergeant, because I was only a Fusilier anyway. But we were both wounded at the same time, and we were in the hospital at the same time.
So, you're going into the line for the first time.
Yes.
What was the procedure for going into the line?
Well, we were on 159 Hill, and it was a matter of looking out for the enemy. We were doing fighting patrols from there, and then we used to go out on lookout to see which was an advanced post. Two of you would go out there, sit there all night, and relay back what the enemy were doing, or whatever you could see that they were doing. And then we used to, 8 or 9, used to go out on a patrol to see whether we make contact with the enemy. A few times we did, and we got away with it, and we were back. And then we were selected, D Company of the Royal Fusiliers, to do a battle called Pimlico. I expect you may have heard of it.
After how long was this?
I suppose that when we were out there, I suppose about 3 months, we were selected, the Fusiliers.
Were you still on Hill 1959?
Yes. And the object of the Pimlico was that 10th Platoon was to go down with Mr. De Roper, and we were to take this mound at the bottom of our hill, which 500 yards, 500-600 yards across this paddy field, there was a hill which was marked up as Mark, which we had to go. And the idea was to disrupt the Chinese and try and take prisoners. 11th platoon's supposed to have gone through to do that part of it, and we were down to take this hill, this mound. On the way down, we met the enemy, the Chinese, and we took care of them and went and took this mound, which was okay. So the others, in the meantime, the Australians and the Durham Light Infantry, I think, were either side of us, and they supposed to they're supposed to have kicked up a little bit of diversion for us while we were doing this, which they did. But what had happened was, in the meantime, prior to going on this Pimlico, we were going to do it 3 or 4 days earlier, but the Chinese had heard about it, and we were going down in this particular night to do it, and the Chinese were waiting for us, so the brigade pulled us back out to save any trouble, and we were on standby to do it again, and then they just called up to do it to this night, which was the 24th. Yeah, the 24th of November, when we did it. We went down, and as I say, we took this mound, and the others, 11 and 12, did their job. We all had bulletproof vests. They gave us all automatic weapons, grenades, and we also had the support of the ships offshore for a barrage, and our mortar company. Well, as soon as we got down there, we met the enemy. We got split up quite a bit. Our platoon, there was about 29 of us, I suppose, and Lieutenant Hoare, he got wounded first, and then the Chinese started to come back at us, and it was so intense with the amount of Chinese there. A lot of us got split on the mound, and me and my mate was with about 6 others, and these Chinese were coming around, and my mate Crocker, he got killed by my side, and that was terrible. And I could have cried, but it was one of those situations where you've got to look after yourself, otherwise you're going to be in the same situation. Anyway, it came around that Lieutenant Hoare was already wounded, and eventually, an hour or so later, we heard that he got killed. He was dead. And it came through that one of the wireless operators, that our company commander had ordered us to move back. Well, everybody was fighting to get back. We got back, and there was, I think on the night, there was 14 killed and 19 injured. But when we got back, there were some there that was injured on the mound where we were, and some of the lads stayed with them. But that's where Georgie Ogdenson, he wireless'd to the battalion that they were being overrun, and that's when he got taken prisoner. And what's his name? Forget his name now. Another one was taken prisoner.
An officer?
Yes. Oh, gosh, I forget his name now. But anyway, we managed to get back, and the rest of the company, but we didn't get no they never got any prisoners. It was all deadlight, you know, everything was fight for life. But the very next day that they asked us to go back, because we knew where quite a lot of the dead were, and I wanted to go back to get my mate Crocker, and they asked 10 of us to go out with a stretcher bearer party, and we went out there, and when we got down there, we saw a few of the bodies and there was some snipers waiting for us. Don't know how many there were, but they were shooting just to make us go somewhere. They could have really picked us off, I would have thought. But anyway, we had to drop the stretcher bearers, and we got into this ditch, and we were up to here in water.
Up to your chin?
Yeah. And we were lying there, and it was a paddy field right in front of us, and the next hill was our lines, but to the right of us was a tank, and we called up for smoke to be put down so as we could run across the paddy field, because it was getting daylight, and you don't do much in daylight out there. It's mainly done by, you know, night. But they put this smoke down everywhere, but we didn't want it. And the Chinese were getting closer and closer, so this sergeant turned around and said, well, we've got to make our own minds up whether we take a chance and we go across that paddy field without no cover, or we stay here and we get taken prisoners. Well, I said, well, I'll go with you, I'm going across. So we got up and we all went. We went across the paddy field. We got across until we got to the hill, 159, and we were going up it, and they saw us going up because it was pretty open, and they lobbed this shell, bang, right in the middle of us, and up we went, a lot of us.
How many of you?
There was 10 of us there. I was wounded. The wireless operator was wounded. And we were virtually nearly in our own lines when it happened. And I never did know how the rest of the lads got on, because I remember bloke putting a tourniquet on this arm, and we were airlifted to a MASH hospital.
What injuries did you have?
I had this arm.
That's your right arm?
Yeah. And all this hand is dead. Well, I'm still having trouble with this now.
With your fingers?
Yes, yeah, so I'm under the hospital now with it all. They're trying to give me physio because I can't move it.
So you were wounded on your right arm at the joint?
Yeah. Yeah.
But inside the elbow?
Yeah, all that. I can't feel. I can't feel the arm. It's,
that's the lower part of your arm.
Yeah, it's all dead. And I went to this American MASH hospital in the field. They patched me up, and then they sent us to Kyuri in Japan.
Were you wounded elsewhere?
No. And we went to Kyuri in Japan, and I was in an Australia ward, and they redone all my arm, and I was there quite a long time. And while I was there, my sister knew that a friend of mine was in the Pay Corps in Japan, and she wrote to him telling him that I was in the hospital in Kyuri, and he came down and saw me.
What did you think to the medical treatment you got after you were wounded?
Unbelievable. Brilliant. I was told that by the Americans that if the British, I know they probably would have said them anything, but they said that if I'd have had it done by the English, I'd have lost my arm. I quite believed I would have lost my arm.
Why should there have been a difference?
I don't know. But it was in such a state that I thought, when it happened, I thought I'd lost my arm anyway.
Do Do you think the Americans were right when they said that you'd have had it amputated by the British?
Well, you don't know. It's really a thing you don't know, really, is it? I mean, I don't say the English are no different from the Americans, my personal opinion, because all the hospitals I've been to here, I mean, I've had wonderful treatment. And when I left Japan, and then when I left Japan in 1953, we flew back and we landed by night. There was a lot of us on board the plane, the Dakota, and the first one we came out, and we stopped in the Philippines to have all our dressings changed in a hospital, and the Americans were doing that. And when we were time to come get back on board plane to go off again, we had an upset on the plane because the plane had burst a tyre. And it span round and round and round, and we thought we'd had it then. And we had to stay there for another week in Manila to get them to repair this plane before we took off again. So we was in this American hospital for a while. And then after we got back on board, and we landed at Lynham Airport, and then the ambulances was waiting for us there, and then they drove from Lynham down to Aldershot Hospital, and that's where I stayed for quite a few weeks in Aldershot, having this done. And then at the finish, they sent me down to Southampton to a recuperation centre. And I was there for quite a while. And then they discharged me from there out of the army.
Can I go back to when you arrived on the hill?
Yeah.
5-9. Can I ask you some questions about what you said, please? You said about the being on lookout. Were there just two of you and you were on lookout?
Yeah, what it was is that what you used to have to do, you used to have to go to, it was like just the edge of your lines where there used to be a lookout post. You were quite high so that you could look at the Chinese if they were digging or whatever they were doing, and you could what you could do, or what they asked you to do, was to ring it back if you saw any movement, and if they wanted to, they could get a position on that and shell it. I mean, you weren't in a lot of danger being there, because I mean, it was an easy exit to get out if there was only two of you. You know, if the Chinese started to come, you were out. So I don't think that very, very, very seldom happened anyway.
Were you observing them through binoculars?
Yes.
So what could you see of them?
Well, you used to see them digging. That was mainly all you could see, because, I mean, they were on the hills the same as we were. And their trenches were so deep, you couldn't really see them anyway. But all you used to see was, like when they were digging, throwing the earth out. And if you saw them doing that, then you give them the position of that, and then they would either shell it or whatever.
So all you could see was the earth, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Not the people.
No. Well, occasionally you might even see one of them, you know, get up and want to do something, and then drop back down again. But they didn't show themselves very often.
You mean do his business?
Yeah, well, whatever.
Had you had orders not to fire?
We had no, we never fired, no. we had a radio that we sent back to HQ.
How could you give the coordinates of their position?
Well, we had a map, and we used to have to, I mean, we were taught to do that anyway, and we used to look on the map and just give it rough. What they knew where the outpost was, and from the outpost we used to give them a degree or whatever, and the length. But the length, they more or less knew where the hill was to the outpost. So it was only saying 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and that was it. That's how they got it.
But you'd have to estimate the distance.
Well, the distance was always the same, because it was the outpost to that particular hill in front of you. So it was near enough the same. I mean, if you was looking at it and they were shelling and you were saying you're falling 10 foot short or something like that, then up they go and bang again.
Were they very accurate?
Fairly accurate, because I mean, it was the same for the Chinese, because I mean, roughly we could tell during the day at daylight what time they would shell us, and normally they would shell us round about lunchtime, and we all used to walk round the back of the hill, let them shell, and then go back.
What time was lunch then?
Oh, about up at 12, 1 o'clock.
So, when you directed fire, was it mortar fire or shell fire?
Mortar fire. Because the mortar fire come from our mortar company. Or mortar platoon light.
How did you like being on lookout?
Well, I think it was reasonably safe. It was, had no fears about it. I think when you get out there, you get over the first couple of weeks, and you get a bit. I think you get a bit hardened to it. It's a matter. I think personally, it was out there was a matter of survival.
So, how did you feel like in the first 2 weeks?
Terrible. The first night. Anybody that said they weren't frightened, they were lying.
What was so frightening about it?
Well, we'd never been under gunfire before, and we'd never been shelled at before. And when you start getting that, apart from when you were a boy, and as I say, the bombs that used to come along in the Second World War, I mean, you'd forgotten all that.
But you'd been warned about being under fire, had you?
Oh, well, we knew we were going to be under fire at certain times. I mean, when they used to attack, I mean, they used to attack and didn't go out on the 10-man fighting patrol. It was double that. If you met a fighting patrol out there, I mean, there was a lot of Chinese there.
You mean they use bigger numbers?
Yeah. Well, that is them, isn't it? You know, I mean, dying to them kind of people is nothing anyway. You know, I always class them with, you know, the Japanese, the life means nothing. That's the way I see it.
And you mentioned the patrolling. How many would the fusiliers put out on a patrol?
Well, usually about 10. On a fighting patrol, usually about 10.
So the Chinese patrol will be double that, you mean?
Usually, yeah, usually. Not very often you come across one with only 5 or 6. It's usually, I would say, more than 15, you know, than ours. They did everything in numbers because they had the numbers. We didn't have the numbers.
So So did you go out on many patrols before Operation Pimlico?
Went out and about, I suppose, about four or five, I suppose.
In 3 months?
Yeah. Because every so often we used to get taken out of the line to have, used to go, which we used to call holiday camp. It was a camp where we used to rest and have baths, or they used to take us in the lorries to the Indian River, mainly, and we used to go in the river and have baths because we were so dirty.
Did you get vermin on your body?
We had a lot of rats. We was always told in the bunkers, when you come off of guard or standby and go into the bunker, you should never, or we were never allowed, or supposed to have never been allowed, to zip up your bedroll. Because we used to have the American bedroll there, and you used to zip them up, but you wasn't supposed to zip them up in case the rats got in the bottom of it, because it was nice and warm. Because we did have one fella there that did zip it up and found he had rats in the bottom, and he nearly got bitten to death. Terrible.
He got a lot of bites?
Yeah, he got a lot of bites. And he was taken out and sent back to Seoul Hospital.
Did the rats bother you much?
No, I mean, if you saw one, you kicked it or got rid of it. But no, it didn't bother me. Yeah, I think you got used to it. It's the way you live out there, and that's it. You've been given that way. You know, you're in the army. You're given that kind of thing, and you just got to get on with it. It's no good to, you know, crying about it. One of those things.
Would they be near enough to kick?
Oh yeah. I mean, your bunker wasn't very big. You know, we used to have it for two of us to get in there and keep warm. That's what it was really there for, to keep warm. Occasionally, you was had a. There was one there, the only Christmas that I spent there, that we were taken out and we was under canvas. And Christmas 52, and we had some entertainers from England come out there to entertain us. And we were all under tents then, and because it was, you know, have a few drinks, listen to the... I forget, who is it? Carol Carr. Was it Carol Carr, the singer? I think she came out and we had a bit of a Christmas party. We were all getting Christmas stuff from home, parcels. And it was quite a good Christmas, actually.
Would it not have been Christmas 51? Because you must have been...
51, yeah.
But did you get body lice or fleas or anything of that kind?
No, we were told, when you came out, you was always deloused. You used to have your clothes taken off and powdered completely down, washed and powdered. They used to call it delousing powder.